You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
That's a gay ass podcast.
What? That's a gay ass podcast.
A what?
A really, really, really gay podcast that we call That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
That's a gay ass name for a gay ass podcast.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It is me, Eric Williams, and this week we have Ben de la Creme back on the podcast. She first came on a year or so ago with Jinx Monsoon promoting their holiday tour, but this is the first time I get a full-length sit-down with De La. And y'all, she does not disappoint. It is very clear why she was Miss Congeniality on RuPaul's Drag Race Season 6 and voted among the 15 fan favorites of all time. Now, I do ask about why she no longer watches Drag Race. Also, I hear about why she is in Chicago, right, meow? And we talk about a whole brunch more. If you would like to see my solo show, I would love to see you there. It is June 25th in Los Angeles, July 17th in New York City, and tickets are, thank God, going fast. But enjoy this interview with the icon that is Ben de la Creme.
Ben de la Creme is calling in from Chicago, Illinois, where you were there to do Teatro Zanzani's gorgeous show. But Ben de la Creme, you did a very short interview with Jinx to promote your holiday show, I got like a year or two back, and now we get a full episode with you. Ben de la Creme, it is an honor to have you back on That's a Gay Ass Podcast. How is your gay ass day going?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, we're at the, at least the first chunk of it. So far, a true delight, only getting better for the next hour or so. I'm really happy that we could come back and do this without Jinx in the room so we can really speak freely.
Yeah, I think we first want to talk about each of our biggest issues with Jinx. I'll go first.
Okay, great.
I think actually what's the gag of the gag is that you are calling from one of, I think, the gayest cities in the country. I think Chicago, every time I'm there, I'm sort of gagged by how hot the guys are, how great the gay bar scene is. Have you been able to at least witness any of the hot guys while you've been?
Not this time around so far. I'm just 2 weeks into this 8-week run, and it's been like kind of a crazy onboarding process. But I'm looking forward to getting back out there. And actually, you know, I lived in Chicago. I went to school here. So I am familiar with this gay scene from the perspective of a newly 21-year-old. So I know what Chicago has to offer to the extreme. I'm both excited to get back out there and interested to, check out what that's like 20 years later.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting thing to do. It's like when I go back to visit where I'm from in St. Louis, Missouri, and I haven't lived there since I was 18, and to see it through, like, I don't know, therapies and gayified eyes, it's very different. Because when you were in Chicago, you were studying at the Art Institute, which is kind of a very elevated gay experience to be with a bunch of fucking art students. But was your first gay experience in Chicago, or did you have any Connecticut gay moments before you moved?
Yes. Yeah. No, I was that kid who was just so queer from such an early age that it was like all the other kids were clocking it before I even knew what that meant. You know what I mean? So it just, by the time I came out, it wasn't like, hey, everyone, I'm gay. It was, yeah, okay. You know?
Sure. Were you having any, like, did you have any gay kisses happening before you left high school?
So my public school that I went to for the majority of high school was in Connecticut. And that was like, very lonely. There were no other queer kids that were, at least queer kids that were out around there. But I went to a school for the arts in Massachusetts for the very end of high school. And I gotta say, that was like the wildest adventure to go from like bottom of the high school food chain. And then going to this school for the arts, it was like I went from being kind of the bottom of the high school food chain to actually being one of the sort of most self-possessed kids. Like suddenly there was no stigma around being queer.
Yeah.
And it was wild because I actually got appreciated for the other aspects of my personality, you know? And so that was a real like pleasant whiplash. So my senior year, I had a boyfriend and he lived in the same dormitory as me.
Dream.
We got in trouble a lot.
Trouble? did they catch you in the act?
Oh, I mean, yes. High school students are not supposed to sleep in each other's dorm rooms.
Sure. But like, can they blame the queer kids who have found each other at the end of their high school experience for getting under the covies?
I mean, here's the thing. Of course, these are like, I mean, this school is, I cannot say enough for like, it's called Walnut Hill. I cannot say enough like how great that was in my experience. You know, you're familiar with it.
Very, yes.
Yes. So it really was like a turning point in terms of my arts education, how accepting it was. And so like, of course, they are responsible human adults who are going to make sure that children are not doing anything that can get anyone in any sort of trouble because they have to protect this environment.
Right.
However, they are also a very loving, caring community. And I also know that they were in many ways happy to see us blossoming into our fullest young selves as we entered adulthood.
I'm like so happily jealous for you because I think that every like theater camp, art school, they probably have to deal with the same thing, which is like there are like beautiful instructors and teachers and counselors who are trying to give these kids a great experience, but also not like actively encourage them to get dick down for the first time in their lives.
Well, and I've also been on the other end where I've been a camp counselor at like, you know, with like queer folks who I was looking after. And it's a very similar thing, you know, it's like there's that it's an interesting thing to navigate as an adult who wants to shepherd queer children into their best lives, but also their children.
It's also just hard being around children, full stop. I feel like because like I think that what I tend to do is look back on my herstory and like psychoanalyze why I am dealing with the shit I'm dealing with today. And I feel like no matter what you do with being around kids, you're not fucking them up, but there's like everything that we do is going to affect a child in a certain way. There's like high stakes being around young people, I feel, because like you are shaping the way they view the world, no matter how what you try. But I think it's interesting that you have sort of like allowed that part of your childhood where it was really tough going to that public school and you were bullied. And then you said there's an interview I read where your first drag persona was Tina Angst, which was really embodying this like angry riot girl punk vibe. And I think it's really cool that you took your frustration as this young person that was deeply misunderstood, I'm assuming bullied a bit at least.
Oh, quite a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and then you used that sort of anger to put it into a character. Would you say that there is still a part of Tina Angst inside of you? Do you still like touch into any of that anger?
Absolutely. I mean, Dela is one very specific part of me and Tina is another specific part of me. And it's just the parts that I sort of choose to express through this art form. And there is like, you know, a very real and intentional reason I made that pivot. And, you know, the birth of Tina Angst was not just out of that childhood experience, right? Because when I was young and in Connecticut, there was like, you know, Will and Grace had started to be a thing. Queer as Folk was out there. We didn't have HBO, so I'd never seen it, but I was like familiar with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, Will and Grace is a wonderfully written, acted, and directed series. It is very, very good. However, it is also reflective of its time in terms of the way that these people you know, lovingly, jokingly, constantly tear each other down in terms of things like physicality, right? Like, you know, I mean, it's very intense. Like, this is like the turning point of the years where we're getting into the beginning of grinder culture, where like mask for mask, no fats, no femmes is in its boom, right? Like that was really hitting hard when I moved to Chicago. And so the messaging with those shows when I was young was very much like, here's the people who are out there living their best lives. So there is a future if you look like that. And yeah. I did not. I was also like a very fat kid. And I was also, you know, I was bullied for that a lot. And so when I moved to Chicago and I turned 21 and I entered the gay scene, I there was equal anger for the way that I was not accepted as myself within that community, you know? Mm. And I think queer scenes everywhere have changed quite a lot, but especially in that era, it was very homogenous, white, gym guy. Everyone had the same haircut and, you know, and it was, and as a queen, I was worshipped. Stepping into those spaces out of drag, I was like this weird little punky kind of, you know, like I was invisible. And yeah. So that duality was the source of a lot of anger for me as well. And so Tina Angst was born out of both of those things, out of like the anger that there wasn't a place anywhere. And it was my way to get on stage in front of those same gays who I felt alienated by and just kind of let them out.
Yeah.
And they of course loved it because I was amazing, but it like, that's where a lot of it came from. And so yes, all of that still exists in me. I like Dela is very like effervescent and positive and an optimist, but that is not like reflective of everything that I am, you know? But when I was living here was also when I decided to kind of make that shift, because there was a queen here named Miss Fousey who is still around. I don't know what she's up to these days, but I had never seen her perform. She just came out to the bars and clubs on the weekends. And she sort of was like, you know, I still think of her as an older queen, even though I'm 100% sure I am now older than she was. but she, you know, sort of wore these big colorful muumuus and like this wild little like Phyllis Diller wig and like eyeshadow, you know, garage door eyeshadow. And she would come around and she'd have like a little basket of hard candies. And right, also indicative of a different era. And she would like go around and she would pass out candy to these guys in the bars, and she called everyone Pineapple. And she was like, hello, Pineapple, how are you tonight, Pineapple? And everyone knew her. And when she walked into a space, it was like all these bitchy gays judging each other suddenly became so much softer and friendlier. And it was like this really solid, clear example. I was watching this and I was like, oh, this is how you change these people. It is not by... It's not through anger. Yeah. That doesn't get anywhere. These people aren't changing the matter I get at them. You know, it is this kind of limit, like sort of wildly unfiltered, generous spirit of kindness. And specifically the way that I think, especially at that time, a lot of young gay men were like, very receptive to a maternal figure who was loving and accepting. And
damn,
that became a big reason for me that I was like, oh, that's the way to change this world. You know,
it makes so much sense, because I think that we often talk about this era where Will and Grace was sort of giving visibility. And you think about, of course, the positivities that we must talk about, but it's also the other side of it is the ways that we were given messaging about how our value lies. And so I think that you finding a way to connect with the gay people dealing with those messages in different ways is indicative of you as an artist trying to figure out, you know, how to best get your message across and connect. Because I find the whole weight thing to be such a mind fuck, and I'm sure it's in every part of the world, but especially in the United States. This is going to sound like a pivot, but I promise it connects. Have you ever watched Couples Therapy on Showtime?
No, I haven't.
It is unbelievable, and there's this it's basically like the best well-done therapy type of show where there are cameras in these therapy sessions and you follow along these married couples. And my friend had a viewing party with like 10 people to watch a show about therapy, which I was like, this could go in either direction. Of course, my husband and I only had one fight in front of everybody, which was like, I would say a success. But there is a person on that show who talks about her journey with being bullied for being bigger as a kid and at camp, I believe, and how terrible the girls were to her. Just like, yeah. I don't even want to like repeat her trauma, but I'll just like, they would like throw things at her and make her like take her clothes off. And basically she's lived her life now looking back at that girl with judgment, saying that she was gross. And the therapist was helping her be like, you know, you were traumatized. And is there a way for you to talk to that person with the rational part of your brain who knows that she, there was nothing wrong with her. And I myself was also, I gained a lot of weight in puberty, which I think obviously a lot of people do. And I literally started to diet when I was like in like eighth or ninth grade. And to the point where my mom asked my doctor in front of me, do you think he has an eating disorder? Which I was like, I'm right here. But I think that it was a moment where I was also witnessing how like Megan Mullally would make fun of Grace and Will would make fun of Grace for like eating so much, even though she was like thin as a rail. And
yeah,
I just think that you're right. Like, especially in the gay community, so much of our value comes from our physicality. And so I think that it's, it makes so much sense that it's sort of infiltrated your artistic journey, especially when you were like going in your early 20s in Chicago.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, that was my experience growing up as a young person. And then I have weighed and looked a lot of different ways over the course of my life. So I've actually had, you know, for those of us who have experienced that, there is a sort of upsetting front row seat you get to the different ways that people treat you.
Yes.
And a lot of people know that in theory, but when you see through your own eyes the way that someone looks at you and speaks to you differently, depending on how you are presenting at that time in your life, it is honestly an ugly window into our culture. And it becomes a thing where, in my experience, again, having gained and lost weight multiple times, compliments also feel like shit, because all they are saying is, I am monitoring you and I have an opinion on your worth based on my view of your appearance. And that is so intertwined with the queer experience, mm-hmm. right? Like these things of my love for you and by extension, your self-love and my self-love for myself are all conditional. And we as queer people, I think, are particularly susceptible to falling into these traps around body image stuff because we have already received so much messaging that the love we receive is dependent on something about how we shift our identities, right? And so I do think that queer people sometimes double down on that thing because they know the pain of it and they don't want to get sucked into something else. You know,
it's a major defense. It's a sense of control over like how we can be treated, which is like, okay, if I get myself really fucking hot, then people will see me as of value. And then at least I can make them think I'm a good person because I look good and they don't want it. They're not going to judge my freaky gayness or whatever the fuck they judge for. Right. It really is so layered, especially with the queer experience. And I think it's so well said, but it wouldn't be a gay ass podcast, De La, if I didn't ask you the famous podcast question. And feel free to go in any direction when I say to you, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame even, babe?
I'm going to say Jim Henson.
Mm.
I'm going to say that that my like Muppetational upbringing really just like from the get-go of watching reruns of the original Muppet show that were just like on TV all the time, that aesthetic. I mean, Jim Henson was not a queer person, but he was so progressive and so like his message was so like, I mean, he was such a weirdo hippie, right?
Yeah,
and
he
was like about humans and community. And that is so reflected in The Muppet Show and the joy of The Muppet Show. And The Muppet Show to me is such camp queer joy. And Miss Piggy is like, was my first introduction to drag.
Yes.
You know, Frank Oz is the best drag queen. And then Jim Henson really, like, that was all kind of like soaking in, but man, did he double down casting David Bowie in Labyrinth. That is when it all came together for me, was like the Muppet madness of the Goblin City with David Bowie's like just snatched eye makeup and codpiece front and center.
There's something about a full beat and a pronounced cock that will really lead us into to the right gay direction. And I think that the Jim Henson answer is so good, because I feel like we're living in an era where we're really appreciating some of that campiness from our childhoods when it comes to Jim Henson, when it comes to Paul Rubens. I don't know, there was that documentary about Pee-wee's Playhouse and his whole life is unfucking real. But I think it harkens to a time where there was queerness dripping from these things, but it was done in the way that they could.
Yes.
Do you think Jim Henson ever fooled around with a guy?
No, I mean, because I've watched the documentaries about him too, you know, and he had like a very loving relationship with his wife that was very also tumultuous. But, you know, to me, Jim Henson was like an early example of what can happen when toxic masculinity is just not present in a straight person, you know.
It's so apparent when a straight guy is like able to hang with the gays.
Totally. It's just like, it's so clear. Like, to me, Jim Henson is a great example of you know, you don't have to have any sort of queer inclination to be fully embracing of the queerness of the people around you, and ultimately the joy of the queer lifestyle as it does not manifest sexually, but just being a fucking weirdo who does weird shit and does whatever you want and forges your own path, you know?
Yeah, I feel like we need to figure out, like, what is the key to making straight men... like, we need to do a bit of a scientific experimentation of all the straight men who have gay friends. What happened to them to make them not complete assholes?
And puppets. Then puppets. It's puppets with Jim Henson. And what about all the straight people who are surrounding Paul Rubens, right? Like Lawrence Fishburne, right? Like, that's the, like, puppets are the
puppets.
The common link.
You know, Ben de la Creme, you have always so many good answers about your work and about your herstory, but it wouldn't be a gay ass podcast with a drag race icon if we didn't get into some of the drag race of it all. Let's just do a couple quick questions about Drag Race. Now, you have obviously been a herstory making queen on the show, but where do you stand with All Stars this season? Are you enjoying the structured bracket sitch?
Well, you know, All Stars 30 is a really cool endeavor that, but I listen, I'm going to be real, real, real.
Be real.
I don't watch Drag Race anymore. Like, I have seen so much Drag Race in my life from every angle. I love and support these queens, and I am really excited about Aja getting back on the TV, getting people's eyes on her again, because I love her. Like, we really bonded on All Stars, and she's just an amazing woman. I'm also really excited about people getting to see Nicole Page Brooks again, because I've worked with her a lot and she is such a delight, and I'm so glad that a new generation of viewer is being exposed to her. But yeah, you know, I've tried many times to figure out whether I like need to watch the show when I do interviews. I've tried to figure out like what sort of like ways I can skirt answering, like actually giving away that I don't watch it. But you know what? I feel like at this point in my career, I have like earned the right to freely say that I don't watch Drag Race.
You more than earned it. And I think that's why we love you, is because of your honesty. And the good news is about you being on this podcast is that this is not a Drag Race podcast where every week I go into what happened the week prior, because I have myself been vocal about how the show is done such great things for drag, of course. But I do feel like the longer that it's on, the less I feel that I am pulled to watch, and more that I'm enjoying the fact that there are so many young people who are like obsessed with it. And I'm like, you know, I'm allowed to support the show and love the show without like being tuned in every single week. But it's just funny when you're like, enter your name onto the World Wide Web, and there are people who are calling for a Best Friends edition of All Stars. There's like, we want Bob and Monet, Trixie and Katya. We want, you know, Jinx and De La, Violet and Gottmik. Is the Drag Race part of your story behind you? Or is there any way that
I have to say, like, people have talked about that, the Best Friends race idea. And I think that for me, if it was like really in the spirit, like part of what's beautiful about all those duos is that we like uplift each other, and like our careers and our lives have all like exploded because of the power of the team, right? And so, you know, for my, and like, listen, everyone loves to call me a Pollyanna all the freaking time, but it really is a thing where, to me, like the spirit of that would be not honored if we were pitted against each other as teams. So what I would like to see for a Best Friends race is like a thing like, okay, first of all, like, I think that this should be a combination of Drag Race and The Amazing Race and that cartoon show from USA Network when I was like 7, where like classic Hanna-Barbera cartoons have to like race each other in like goofy cars. Sure. So I'm like, put each of the pair, we each have to design our own car, like our, you know, and then we have to like travel cross country to like, and you know, make different stops on our treasure hunt. It's like, make it a thing that is about like fun and weirdness and like these drag teams like having to do shit. But like, I don't want to go there. I do not want to go on there and fight with Gottmik and Violet Chachki. That sounds like a nightmare. I love them in real life, but have producers tell them to yell at you? Absolutely not. I don't
want
When
they're
that.
All cylinders firing and shading somebody, there's no survivors.
I, for whatever reason, I've really always been on Violet's good side, like in a major way. I would never want to put myself in a circumstance of switching that.
And you know what? That's a smart businesswoman right there. I would kill to see an Amazing Race. I feel like it's like you're pitching the gay version of like the Real World Road Rules, The Challenge. Like, I feel like we want to high stakes, but duos in drag.
Totally. I actually don't know why I just gave away this idea. I should be pitching this idea to networks.
And by the way, if and when you do that, we will just be here to sign the petition and Great. To help you promote it when it gets inevitably green lit. But I do love your relationship with Jinx. It's like, I was lucky enough to see your holiday show, which Mazel Tov on winning the Queerty Award last year for Best Live Theater, very deserved. You also directed Jinx's Carnegie Hall show on Valentine's, which seeing her sell out Carnegie Hall is like an unbelievable feeling. You also directed Monet Exchange's Life Be Life and show. You have so many of your own solo shows. I just want to say Mazel on. What was it like, first of all, seeing Jinx perform at the Tonys? Was that sort of like a cool friend prideful moment?
I mean, it was amazing. And it was also like, yeah, you know, this whole journey with her has been like, uh-huh. You know, it's like, and I had just seen her live in Pirates like a couple weeks prior. So it's like, I knew the show, I knew her role, and it was amazing to see it on TV. It was amazing to have, you know, all these people texting me and like, oh my God, I just watched Jinx on the Tonys. But, you know, every step of this has, to me, just been like, okay, cool. Yeah, like people have figured out what I have known for 15 years, you know? But to get to see her have those dreams realized is just amazing on a personal friendship level, you know? All of her friends like believed in her in this specific way, and ultimately she did too, and that's how she's gotten where she's gotten, you know what I mean? Like, you really have to like go at this stuff with a certain amount of confidence that you actually are capable of doing it in order to do it, you know?
Well, that's, yeah, they say that too about like kind of confidence and delusion is, I'm not, like, I come from a place of, I don't want to just blanket it as insecurity, but I very much come from like a place of worrying that I'm never good enough. It's sort of like the mantra that I constantly try to push through. And I am inspired by you and Jinx because of creating all of your work, but especially you with doing your solo shows. I just literally started to perform a solo show about a month ago, and I'm now bringing it to New York next month, and I'm going to tour it in the fall. And it's been a very hard thing to do, but you have Ready to Be Committed, Terminally Delightful, Inferno a Go-Go, Cosmos. I mean, you have all these shows that you've created. Do you have any advice for someone who has similar aspirations like you, Ben De La Creme, like Jinx Monsoon, who knows that they are on a lifetime journey of like putting out work that says something, but they're not yet at the point of their career where like they're getting the success financially or from the industry? Like, do you have any either advice or things that you wish you had been told as you were coming up?
You know, I think that I was very lucky in that I think a lot of the events of my early life, it was like so chaotic, and in many ways I felt hopeless when I was young, in this way that really gave me a what is there to lose kind of approach, you know? Gotcha. And the thing about all of this, because, you know, obviously I did this stuff for many, many years before I could actually support myself on it, you know? And my earlier work was not as strong as my later work. And you have to make bad things first in order to get good at them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think to me, it's like, you know, and that self-doubt that you're describing, I still experience it constantly. I don't think Jinx would be betrayed for me to share that she does as well. It's like, there is no level of success at which you stop experiencing that. And that and confidence are not mutually exclusive. You know what I mean? It's like, it is not... It's the same way, you know, they talk about how bravery is not the absence of fear. It's doing something in spite of the fear, right? So it's like... It's not waiting until you feel inspired or don't feel a fear of failure. It's just doing it anyway. And then it's that practice and repetition that makes it better and better until you're able to make it fly, you know. But I think that it's, you know, there, you just make a peace with the fact that successful art, and in many ways a successful life, is about throwing yourself into the void over and over and over and getting a little bit more comfortable with the discomfort of just, I don't know what's going to happen. I just have to put myself out there and maybe fail or maybe not. There's no way to know, but standing on this ledge is not leading anywhere. So,
yeah. And I think it's like that really is good to hear, because I think that my dream is that I wake up one day and I'm like, okay, I'm fixed. I feel good in my body. The show's amazing. My career is perfect. My personal life is even, it's like, I like want to wake up with the flip switched, if you will. But I am starting to learn that the more like I've done, that's a gay ass podcast. We did this crazy live show with a million people, and I was full fight or flight vibes leading up to the first one. Just like, I thought if the show was bad, the world would end, which of course was not the truth. Then putting up the solo show for the first time, it was a little better, but I was still talking about it every week in therapy. And then it's starting to become clear to me that you're saying that throwing yourself into the void is truly the only way to do it, no matter how terrible you feel, knowing that the void is always going to void, but the work will get better by throwing yourself into it.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think one thing that has been really helpful for me is that all those feelings of fear of failure, of what if this time it doesn't work, what if I'm not good enough, those will never stop coming up. But what you realize is that those feelings actually aren't an indicator of anything. You know what I mean? Like, the feelings can come and go. And that has absolutely, the fact that I've experienced those feelings so many times and it's never actually tanked anything I've done.
Yeah.
Has, you know, it's the more you do it, like the better you get at your work, but you also get just more used to like those thoughts don't actually manifest. So I can just like let them come and go.
Well, it's probably partly why that you are able to work on so many different projects. I mean, I know that you are already looking forward to the upcoming holiday tour. You were literally thrown into Teatro Zanzani. Like, how much rehearsal did you have before going into it?
Well, you know, so the actual amount of rehearsal that we did, I came to Chicago 10 days before opening night, and we just did like 10 hours a day of rehearsal with no breaks. It was so crazy. And then, but then before the director, who is also the drag comedian position I stepped into.
Yeah, yeah.
And who has been with Zanzani for 25 years and is a brilliant comedian. He and I were working together remotely sort of for like a month or so, kind of like starting to figure out how we were developing this material for me and making Zanzani De La flavored, you know? So that was like, and that's how so many of my projects go, because I'm like doing, it's how Jinx and I work with the holiday show. It's like, you know, like check in every couple of weeks, here's some thoughts, da da da. And then, okay, now the show is in a month, let's, you know.
That's kind of I think a brilliant way to work, though, because as you're like sort of sitting on the eggs of, you're trying to birth a project, you can check in on it, and then when it's time to hatch, baby, you got to get the nursery ready. You got to whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all that stuff is, whether you know it or not. And that's another thing that I've learned to trust, right? Yeah. Like if you start like touching those things early on, they will be bubbling in the back, even if you're totally unaware of it. Once you revisit, you'll be like, oh wow, I have a lot of new developments rattling around in there, you know?
Oh, totally, totally. It's incredibly exciting to be able to talk with you in this way, because the last time I spoke with you, when you were kind of in that like craziness of getting ready for the show. But I find that now having you one-on-one, it's like, it's always very important for me to tell people like you how much you inspire me, because I think that going from the difficulties of growing up and like being bullied, and I know like not if it's okay with you to go into a bit of a sadder topic, but I think, you know, reading about how you lost your mother when you were so young as well, and then being able to take the difficulties of growing up and use it as a strength now. And I'm kind of, it's been on top of mind for me, the family stuff of it all, because like, you know, I feel like Mother's Day and Father's Day are so close together, and we're literally recording this right before. I just want to read something that you wrote about your mom on Mother's Day that really touched me. You said, "Shout out to those for whom Mother's Day is a rough one. Today, I am 53 days older than my mother ever got to be. Living is weird. Dying is weird. But happy Sunday to everybody who has a mom or doesn't have a mom or used to have a mom or never had a mom or is a mom or wasn't a mom or was a mom or will be a mom or won't be a mom or had to be their own mom." There's something so beautifully vulnerable about that. And I think that you carry that vulnerability in your work with genius comedy. And I just think that it's so important that you put your heart so openly for us, and that's why we eat it up. And I wanted to let you know that that was so, so meaningful to me.
Thank you. That means a lot. It's, I do feel really grateful to get to share that type of vulnerability through my comedy and through my work and through the sort of buffer of sequins and makeup and dick jokes. You know what I mean? It's like, I think that part of what I love about drag and camp so much is that it really is that spoonful of sugar that then, you know, you sort of can lead somebody somewhere with this sort of this like joyful, ridiculous, irreverent, dirty humor. And then, but once you have them, they've already opened themselves up to you. And then you can be like, hey, let's have the real human experience. And,
yes. And
I think that's healing for me, because I continue to in my life look for that connection, that affirmation that only comes from connecting with other living consciousnesses, and that getting to, I have found that the best way to receive something is to give it in that regard. You know, the more I open myself up and am vulnerable in those ways, the more I get to have experiences where people like you say something like that to me. You know, and starting the vulnerability, you get surprised by how many people want to be vulnerable with you as well.
100%. And I hope to continue to learn from you and the way that you put yourself out there. And before we do get to the final podcast question, I just want to feed our gay souls by asking you, what is something that you do that does feed your gay self? Is there something, whether you're in Chicago, are we enjoying a gay bar? Are we just going to see another show? Are we watching a shitty television series? What is feeding Ben de la Creme's gay soul?
Okay, so I think the only thing I could say that would be gayer is flower arrangement, but I'm going to say it is curating interiors. That is like truly, so my actual home in Los Angeles, I am so meticulous about my surroundings, and I am like a flea market freak. Like, I am the person who is waiting outside at 6 a.m. for the trucks to arrive so I can go with my phone flashlight and like see what's in there before anybody else does. Like, I am person. So I love to collect objects that have had some sort of history. I don't need to know it, but like, I love, like, you know, some sort of vintage like glassware that I'm like, some lady had to collect all these pieces, or some closeted gay man back in 1950 something.
Yep.
And like individually do this and then pass them on and have them survive for this many decades, right? Like, I love that shit. And so I really, you know, my place at home looks like the like craziest, most eclectic mashup of Pee-wee's Playhouse and like a antique mall. Yeah. And that brings me such joy. Like, I love to curate my space. And so here I am in Chicago. I'm in the artist housing that they provide, which is an apartment just a couple blocks from the theater. And I got in here and I was like, oh my God, this is so just like sterile. It is just one of those apartment buildings with like zero personality. And I'm only here for 2 months. I am the next person to live in this apartment is getting a great gift, because that is how I find my peace. Is I'm like,
they're like, why are these glasses from 1962 in the cupboard?
I mean, I'm literally buying like carpets and art. Like, it's like not, it's a ridiculous use of time, of money and resources and time, but it is, brings me great joy.
It's gay self-care. It's gay self-care. And I think we can add to your pitch then for the Gay Amazing Race, where there has to be some design challenge where you have to gay up a room in a certain amount of time and make it representative of the city that you're in. I'm just trying to add to your, to the.
I love this. But thrift stores and flea markets only.
Exactly. There was actually a show my husband and I watched for years, Flea Market Flip, I believe, or something, where like basically like they would find couples that were really great at doing what you do. And then, of course, they were like, how much can they sell these reupholstered things that they found? Whatever. It's just, there's a reason why us gays love a good interior, and it's because we make the exterior brighter and gayer. Ben de la Creme, I'm going to ask you the final gay ass podcast question, which is, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress, who would you save?
I feel like this is one of those questions that I'm sure for most people changes from day to day and maybe even hour to hour. But in this particular moment, the person who is on my mind is Amy Adams, who I feel like people would not necessarily consider a character actress, but she 1000% is. She has such range and versatility. Speaking of Muppets, stunning in the Muppet movie. The rebooted one, whatever. So incredible in Disenchanted.
Yes.
Right? Or sorry, Enchanted, and then Disenchanted. Yeah. Both of them. She's incredible in both of them. Her ability to like bring the sophistication and nuance of her very serious roles into these very silly roles. There are moments in Enchanted where you watch like 14 emotions flash across her face and through her fingertips.
Well, but giant it's like, eyes too. Like she's a character actress in the body of an ingenue who isn't afraid to be a character actress. And there's something, as like gay people who like pretty things, there's something so satisfying about seeing her be so wackadoo, give us sing song stress, give us her film debut in Drop Dead Gorgeous. I mean, she clearly...
Well, and if you dig back into her history, you can see her as Marvel Ann in Charles Bush's Psycho Beach Party, which is one... That's one
Wait,
of the first
things... she actually
things.
Did that?
Yes. In the film version
I
of
had
Psycho
no
Beach
idea.
Party. Yes. So the film adaptation of the infamous stage play by Charles Bush... Charles Bush's role, Chicklet, is played by Lauren Ambrose, who is brilliant in it. Charles Bush creates a new role for himself as this, like, lady detective. And Amy Adams is, like, the bitchy girl at the beach who is, like, the mean one who messes yes. up everybody's life. And she is incredible.
I'm so embarrassed that I did not know that, because I got to do Psycho Beach Party in New York with one John Early as Chicklet back in like
Amazing.
2010 or something. And I
what role were you playing?
I played Provolone, one of the yeah. gay surfer dudes. And John was like, as you can only imagine, if that show was done like commercially now, I'm sure he would win a Tony. It was just like unbelievable. But I was like 20 years old, 21 years old, and fell in love with Charles Bush because of that play. And the fact that Amy Adams was in the movie, I need to dive in.
You've got to see it.
Damn. Teaching the Children has always been to the creme. A gorgeous answer. A gorgeous episode of That's a Gay Ass Podcast. I'm so thankful you came on. It is always so lovely to see you. And I'm very excited for your run in Teatro Zanzani, closing July, or you're there till July 19th. Will you tell the listeners where they can follow you and where they can get those sexy tics?
Yeah, I am across social media platforms just at Ben de la Creme, BendeLaCreme. And I've been posting the ticket links to directly through my socials to Teatro Zanzani, but you can also just go to teatrozanzani.com.
Hell fucking yeah. Ben de la Creme, break a leg in the rest of the run. And I am just always such a goddamn fan.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so grateful that we got to be so gay together today.
Always and forever. Thanks for listening to the genius Ben de la Creme on That's a Gay Ass Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, tag me on Instagram. I'm at Eric Wills, and the podcast is at Gay Ass Podcast. There is a very controversial bonus up on Substack right now with Claude, who shot the poster for my solo show. It's controversial because my biggest internet crush has commented that he is not into me, but into Claude, who is not even on Instagram. So go to substack.com/@Eric Wills to see his sexy ginger face and let him defend himself there. Again, it's substack.com/@Eric Wills, where there's a lot more gay assery to come. I'll see you June 25th for my solo show in LA. And please, y'all, just stay gay.
You've been listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, hosted by me, Eric Williams. If you want to see and hear more, make sure you're subscribed to us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, or Patreon at Gay Ass Podcast. That's a Gay Ass Podcast is executive produced by Eric Williams and produced by Nathaniel McClure. We'll see you next week.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.